some prelude, Bob Morley and I met in Las Cruces, New Mexico in 1977, and we have been close friends ever since, nearly 50 years. Bob and I are of kindred spirits in many ways, and Bob has a background in Kansas that he shares in this sermon. And I want to remind us that really the Christian tradition sort of made spiritual autobiographies a part of our culture. That is to say, you read in Acts three different times where Paul talks about his conversion experience, as an example. I'm studying for this fall a lecture I'm giving on Augustine's Confessions, which was another part of that autobiographical tradition. This sermon is an autobiographical sermon about Bob's coming to Christ, and he sees himself as one of those lost sheep that God found. Now, as they do in the theater, I'm now going to make myself into Bob. According to the Bible, the road that leads to salvation is straight and narrow. At least that's what I was told over and over when I was a kid. Growing up in a small town in Kansas in the 1950s, I always thought that I would have an advantage when I got to the big gates in the sky if the phrase straight and narrow was ever used to define any place and time. It would be Eudora, Kansas in the 1950s. Straight in all the ways that that word implies. Straight talk, straight cornrows, straight behavior. And narrow in every way as well. The distinctions of liberal and conservative did not exist in Kansas in the 1950s. There was only one way to think, believe, and behave, narrow. And in the spring, when the planting was all done, the tent revivals would come to town, set up usually in the park downtown. I always went. I wasn't religious, and my parents had no need for church, but it was a grand social event, like a hayride or, heck, a dance, or for that matter, a preacher pounding on the pulpit. And it was an opportunity to see someone from the outside world where people didn't go to work every morning in bib overalls, those kinds of folks who would come to town. And even though the evangelist was different every year, the format was the same. Lots of singing, several offerings, and a long sermon. And the preacher would go on and on describing his sinful life to the delight of us wide-eyed, small-town yokels. Then, in the last minute or so, tell us how his life had been changed because he found Jesus. And then he would give the altar call. And the pitch was always the same. If we died in our sins, God was going to toss us into eternal fire where there is weeping and gnashing of teeth if we did not respond. It was always painfully obvious to me that these outsiders had no understanding of real small-town life in Kansas. There wasn't that much sinning available to us teenagers. Oh, yes, I did shoot out a streetlight once with my BB gun. Did that count? But if God was going to send me to hell for that one infraction, then I didn't want anything to do with him. So I would concentrate my attention on the real reason I came to the revival, the cheerleader. I knew that she would be there because her parents were church types, and I was smitten. And having been born with not a single athletic bone in my entire body, I knew that I was far below her class. The myth about cheerleaders and athletes being true. So I remind myself to adoring her from afar, an agony that I would suffer through 4 years of high school. I would pick up my paper hymnal and my cardboard fan with a tongue depressor handle provided by the funeral home and enter the tent with the yellow bug lights, folding chairs, and sawdust trail leading to the mourner's bench, and choose a seat about three rows behind the cheerleader. I would position myself in such a way as to appear to be looking at the preacher while actually admiring her. Now, the preacher would rant on about something, and I would fantasize about her freckles, and then it happened. There was someone behind me. You know how you feel the presence of another person without looking? Then that person put their hand on my shoulder. I thought to myself, oh no, it's one of those super Christians who has noticed that I have always come to these things but have never gone forward down to the mourner's bench, even if they sang 47 verses of Just As I Am. So I turned to see who had the audacity to invade my private space, and there was no one. But the presence was palpable and warm and loving. Could it be, Joseph Campbell has reminded us, that if you regularly present yourself to a place set aside for devotion, sooner or later something will happen to you? Paul said that the gospel is the power of God for salvation. And it seems that the gospel, no matter how poorly presented or to what extent the hearer is tuned out to something else, that power remains. And the Spirit blows through those words. And in the years that followed, the cheerleader, as prescribed, rotated boyfriends according to the sports season. And I admired her from the other side of the football field or the gymnasium, positioned proudly as first chair trumpet. In the school band, which sadly carried absolutely no social currency. And it happened one day while I was riding in the car with my mother. Bob, by the way, aside, showed me this spot in Eudora, Kansas. We were going to Eudora, to Safeway, to buy groceries for the week. I would always entertain myself by playing with the car radio, and the preset knobs were set on stations that you could hear the following: Hank Snow or Ernest Tubb, the Midwestern Hayride, or the latest price of hog futures. And I was curious what might else be on the airway, so I turned the knob, and that's what had happened. I heard a sound like I had never heard or imagined ever hearing. The DJ said it was a new singer from Memphis singing this new song, "You Ain't Nothing But a Hound Dog." Remember that? My life was changed. I have often used it as an explanation to explain why I turned out the way I did. I had to deal with love, puberty, a divine encounter, and the birth of rock and roll all at the same time. That's a lot. And it turned out there was yet another way for a guy to be cool in Eudora, Kansas, other than athletics and fast cars and big tractors. Within weeks, I became proficient enough on my new used Fender guitar to pound out the three chords necessary to play every rock song coming out of the radio speaker. You know those three tunes. I started a rock and roll band and began playing sock hops at the high school. Imagine the wonder and amazement when the word drifted back from other towns where I had played in their school gyms that I was now considered cool. Those kids with whom I had been in school since the first grade could not believe their eyes. Before long, even the cheerleader was beneath my league. I'm not going to tell you the last sentence. I became the busiest boy in Eudora, Kansas, playing gigs two nights a week and then going to church three times a week, even prayer meeting, and serving as the president of the Youth for Christ Bible Club. My dad remarked in his rather critical manner, "It's all right if you want to take on a little religion, but you don't need to be a fanatic." He was wrong. That was the only way for me to be a disciple of Christ, all in. Those were in the religious communities who thought of my religious conversion and my playing rock and roll for dances saw those as incompatible. A pastor of another church told me rock and roll was the heartbeat of the devil. I think he meant that quite literally. A lady in my congregation just shook her head and said, "I don't know how you can sing rock and roll at a dance hall on Saturday night and come to church Sunday morning and sing How Great Thou Art." And I said, "Well, you really have to keep your voice in shape." I like that line. You see, the God who encountered me in that tent revival under those yellow bug lights was not the same God as the one all the preachers were talking about. Not the God of rules and judgment and guilt and condemnation, but the God of love and grace and beauty and freedom. It was on the same night that this happened. I was walking home from that revival meeting, thinking about the mysterious thing that had happened, inexplicable, but undeniable. I was walking down Main Street. He showed me this place, too. The street was empty and quiet. Sidewalks nearly rolled up and put away, as was our custom. I was right in front of Coleman's hardware store, where there then stood the presence, as real as the singing of the cicadas in the elm trees. Again, it was warm and loving presence, not at all fear-inducing, welcoming and welcoming me. So I spoke to the presence, my first prayer. I remember what I said verbatim. God, if you're real, I'm prepared to be convinced. I waited for something to happen, not a lightning bolt, perhaps a dove landing on a tree branch or a pause in the humming of the cicadas. Nothing happened, but something actually did. There was a certainty implanted within my heart, not only that God was real, but that God loved me and wanted to keep me company for the rest of my life, an offer I couldn't refuse and had no inclination to do so. Rather, I jumped at it and I fell into the full embrace of God's love and grace. So my favorite of all the parables is called The Lost Sheep. There's an old gospel song based on the parable. It begins like this. There were 99 who safely lay in the shelter of the fold. But that's not what the story says. It says the shepherd left the 99 in the wilderness. The wilderness was where Jesus went to be tempted by the devil. It's not a safe place. Then he has the audacity to say, "Who among you would not leave the 99 to seek out the one that was lost?" It's good that all that is left is a rhetorical question, because the answer must be no shepherd with any sense would do any such thing. It's bad business to leave 99 unattended to go look for one stray. Just cut your losses and play it safe. The parable is not an argument for a new policy in the sheep herding industry. It is an illustration of just how far love will go. And the parable finishes with the affirmation that there's more rejoicing in heaven over the one that was rescued than the 99 who needed no rescue. The kingdom that Jesus came to usher in was one in which love was the only currency. The early church chose to see the crucifixion as somehow related to the ritual of blood sacrifice, but they chose not to think of it that way only. God was doing a new thing, a new covenant, in a new way to usher in the age of grace and love. The crucifixion was not, in fact, intended to satisfy some blood ritual from the ages past. It was an illustration in the new order of just how far love will go. Now, Kansas is a flyover state. Nobody ever goes to Kansas on purpose. I'm sorry. I'm just reading. Billy Graham came to Kansas City once, but Kansas City is in Missouri. The biggest town in Kansas is Wichita. It's big enough that it should be a city by now, but it remains just a big flat town. Kansas has the world's largest hand-dug well and the world's largest belt buckle. Did you know that? And it has the world's largest grain elevator in Hutchinson. The Dalton gang was from Coffeyville, Kansas, but Jesse James came from Missouri. Emmett Kelly was from Kansas, which accounts for his sad face. Kansas is happy to claim the Wizard of Oz, but did you know that Frank Baum, the author, never actually went there? He picked Kansas because it was the place most likely to have witches and tornadoes. Nobody goes to Kansas, really. At least not anybody really important. But somebody did. And that somebody became really important to this skinny, shy, unathletic kid without much potential. The God of the universe, the Lord of Lords, the King of Love, came to Kansas for me. He found me in a little town with 1,500 people and 1,300 dogs, walking down Main Street one night, right in front of Coleman's hardware store, and made me an offer that changed my life. And that's how far love will go. Amen.